Second half of the program begins right now. Seren Petro with you here in the program. We are going to talk some baseball here. We are very fortunate to be joined on our Sprint guest line by Lonnie Goldberg. He is the Royals assistant general manager as they get ready for the draft. And he's, as I said, on our Sprint guest line. Lonnie, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good. Strange times, right? Like, you never thought you'd be putting together a five-round draft, did you?
No, not in any shape or form did we anticipate this, and so it's unusual. But you know, I give our staff a lot of credit. We put in a lot of time and a lot of work, and we're doing everything we can to put the last finishing touches on putting this board together, and looking forward to it. I mean, obviously, at some point you get tired of doing these Zoom calls, so I'm looking right forward to the draft actually starting.
So tell me, what you know, we know obviously you're not going to be taking 35 other players. That's the major thing that's different. And they've capped at $20,000 what you can offer anyone who's not drafted. So what is this? Let's start with what this has done to the talent pool. You have a lot of kids that have said, like, listen, don't even bother, I'm going to college. Is it a Royals market, or is it a Yankees market, right? From a standpoint of, does that make it easier for the Yankees to go get guys after those five rounds, or for you to go get guys? What does this landscape mean?
Well, I think that you got to have support from your ownership and your general manager to start off with, and we obviously have tremendous amount of support in that regard. We've got our player development system and how we do things that put us up and back us up with being able to talk to players, talk to families, talk to these individuals and put them in a spot where they feel comfortable with our organization. So we have a jump start on that, I would say. And for us, I mean, we've been aggressive throughout the process from the beginning when we were told the rules to where we're at now. And, you know, we're going to be aggressive, but we're not going to be reckless, but we're going to be aggressive in what we do. And I don't want to, you know, Yankees, whoever it is, we've got to compete. And we'll compete in this draft, and we'll compete when the draft's over.
But is there any competition to be had when everybody can only spend the same amount?
Yeah, of course there is. I think if you're going to try to break the tie between, you mentioned the Yankees and us, well, what are you going to do to break it? And it comes down to relationships that you have with players, relationships you have with agents, and then describing a path and a journey to the big leagues. And you can only do that if you believe wholeheartedly in your organization and what it provides. And we've been able to find ways to get our message out there and continue to spread what we do. And we've probably learned a lot in this process and learned things that we can be doing throughout the year. But we've really relied on our player development staff and what they do, and we've been able to sell that. And you know, hopefully, when the situation presents itself, we'll be able to acquire as much talent as we feel we need to. But you're right. You started it with our kids going to go back to school, and I think it's going to be a very volatile type fourth and fifth round because nobody in baseball has ever had to deal with this. The players haven't. The agents haven't. We haven't. The college coaches haven't. So I think it's going to be a very interesting period once that fourth round hits. And then, you know, you got players sitting around wondering if their name's going to get called. It's much different than the NFL draft. I've said this several times. Those guys enter into the draft. These players obviously have an opportunity to go back to school. So there's going to be a lot different than the NFL draft.
I know how much it meant to Royals employees when it was announced that the team would not be furloughing any employees, would not be laying off any employees, and only the upper ends of management would be taking pay cuts. But even then, when better economic times come around, the team will look to make those employees whole on the money that they were owed. I think that's phenomenal. I applaud that from the organization. I thought it was great. I know Dayton Moore was a driving force on that kind of thing, and he also was very, presidential, right, in saying, listen, it ain't my money, right? And so Mr. Sherman and the ownership group, it's their money that's coming out. I just thought it was a great day for the Kansas City Royals organization, for the people that work here in Kansas City. But as we know, a lot of the team is not just here in Kansas City. It's your minor leagues. And while teams are letting go of minor leaguers all over, the Royals didn't do that. And, you know, very swiftly and said, we're not cutting the minor league guys. Number one, I applaud you as part of that organization, everyone in the organization, for doing that. I think it's the right thing to do. But does that pay dividends? How much does that help when you are out there? You talk about the relationships with scouts and with families. You know, that to me is the biggest statement that an organization can make. That's got to do wonders for you as far as building those relationships.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, the leadership at the top with Dayton and Mr. Sherman did, and the other owners to support, you know, obviously the players and the employees here in the organization. I could not tell you how many text messages I got from other employees from other organizations, agents, just several people commending what we did here. And, you know, We know what it's like to work here. We understand the environment we have, and we know how fortunate we are and the people that we work with and what we stand for. And then to have it even more known throughout baseball was encouraging. And I do think, back to your point, I mean, that's where we should break every tie. If there's a tie and a player wants to make a decision on where he's going to go, I think between families, between agents, between other players and other systems, between kids that are in our system that maybe they've got a player that they played with in college, this is the place to be. And this is the place where you're going to get an opportunity, if you're given one by us, to reach your ceiling and ultimately your goal, which is to play in the big league. So I agree with you completely, and I commend Mr. Sherman and Dayton for what they did.
We're talking to Lonnie Goldberg, Royals assistant general manager. Does the five rounds – and, of course, there are the compensation picks in there as well. You guys have two of them, right? So you'll have seven picks. Is that right?
No, we have six. We have one at 32, and then our second-round pick is at 41. So we just have one.
Oh, 40. Okay, so 41 is the second-round pick. Okay, so six picks. Does that, though, does the five rounds give more? Like, we know one of the things that goes on, that there's the recommended slot money. That's you know, the way, I don't know, what do we have, 5 or 6 years of doing business that way. If you can find a guy and sign him, get him, that he would agree that, listen, I'll sign for less than slot money, gives you more money to work maybe on a guy later on. And Sean Manaea was a guy that was a great move by the Royals, and he obviously helped pave the way to a World Series by trading him, was all said and done. But it was a great, great maneuvering by the Royals to make that all work and get Hunter Dozier right up high, who's obviously become a very productive player. So does less rounds make it easier to maneuver like that? Or does it make it more difficult? Does lopping off the other 35 rounds mean that you really don't have much wiggle room?
I think it makes it a lot more difficult. Obviously, you know, 35 extra picks is 35 chances that are given to scouts and players, right? So you know you're going to add depth. One thing that our guys have done a tremendous job in is finding value deep in the draft, and you usually find that in pitching. And we've been able to do that and have a pretty good success rate in doing that. And so when you all of a sudden realize, okay, that's cut drastically short, now the talent and the pool of players and the money that you might be able to spend, you realize you're just not going to get the same amount of players. That's just how it is. I mean, it's one of the most difficult games to play in the world, and you're dealing with 17 and 18-year-old kids and 22-year-old kids. So the pool of players that we're selecting from in our sport is much different. And so we want as many chances as possible as we can, because we run it all summer. We run it all fall. We're out there trying to do everything we can to see as many players and put ourselves in a position to do so. And the five rounds is going to cut into that, obviously. So, but the one thing that we're all on the same playing field, every organization, we're all dealing with the same thing. The disappointing thing is that there's going to be several players that deserve an opportunity to play professional baseball this year, and they're not going to get a chance to. And that's just the situation we're in right now. We've done so many drills here and we've talked about so many players that we've drafted that are in our big league team, that have played on World Series teams, that are some of the best players we have in our organization, like Whit Merrifield, that might not have gotten a chance to be selected in this type of draft. So we're going to do the best we can. We're going to put the board together strategically as possible and try to get the best we can out of the six picks that we've been given.
How valuable in your assessment of players are the games that they play the year you draft them? Because you're only getting a handful or none of those games with these guys. How much more difficult is that job to assess who they are by not getting that last look?
Yeah, I think you go in and you have your pref list and you have your follow list put together, but at the end of the day, you've always known you're going to go see these guys play in the spring, and bodies change. Let's be honest. I mean, guys' bodies change, especially the high school players. And not being able to do that and not being able to, especially with high school pitching, because in the summers, you got to remember, we only see these guys pitch at two innings at a time, you know, at the showcase event. So we're not really seeing them in a lot of cases for five or six innings. You'll get to see a select few do that, but the majority of the country, at times, you don't really get a chance to do that. You have an advantage with the college players because you got more history and more time and you got more video work. So it really comes down to, especially now, it really comes down to the work that your area scouts have done, the comfort level they've gotten with the player and the family, and the comfort that they give you as a scouting director and our cross-check staff, that the conviction that they have and belief in the player. But there's no scout out there that doesn't want to be able to put the finishing touches on a player and have complete conviction when they walk into the room and sell their player to the organization. I think we all want that. So we've had to change how we've done things. And done a lot of video work, a unbelievable amount of Zoom calls, an unbelievable amount of research and checking and diving into opposing coaches and what they're seeing. And, you know, we've done as much as we can, and we're continuing to work through it, and we will as we put the board together and put the finishing touches on it. But, you know, you're 100% right. You'd love to see these guys play. That's the one thing. At the end of the day, we all love baseball. And we believe in baseball, and we believe in the game, and you want to see kids compete. And not getting a chance to see kids compete and get an opportunity to do something that they love, that's difficult as well.
You last year were in a situation where you had the second pick, and most people said, everybody said, I don't know who didn't say it, there are two guys that are worth the number one overall pick. So it seemed like a situation mm-hmm. where you couldn't possibly lose. The song is a little bit different this year. The story that I hear, and you tell me if this is wrong, is that you've got the fourth pick this year in a year that there's three guys. And doesn't mean that they're going to go 1, 2, 3. And we mentioned the kind of the maneuvering. I've read different things on where maybe somebody drafts someone for slot purposes to open up more money to maneuver around later on. But what's your reaction? How accurate is it that there's kind of three top guys and then the next tier?
Yeah, I think it is a little bit different, as you mentioned. You know, we had such confidence in where we were at last year. We had a tremendous amount of time we had spent with Junior and Bobby as a family, so we felt very, very comfortable there. I think this one is a little bit more wide open, and I think the fact that, you know, we didn't get as many looks on players as we would have liked to, I think that's why it's going to be wide open. And I think that's going to be wide open for everybody in this draft. We've all read the same names that are supposed to go at the top, but at the same time, you know, until this thing gets going and starts to really kick off, we'll see how it kind of unfolds. But it's a good group. It's a very deep group, and there's a lot of good makeup in this draft. And so we feel real good with where we're at. We're still having those tough conversations, and we're trying to pick apart everything we can and then build it back up and talk real highly of the group that's available. But I do think it's going to be a little bit more wide open than it was last year.
So compared to most years, obviously last year when you're pick number two, there's way less variables. Compared to most years, your confidence of who's going to go where, is it comparable or is it like, hey, I know that we won't look at these mock drafts as fans and we see the same few names up there, but in reality, it is totally wide open.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think there's a consensus of who may go one, but I don't know that. That's what we're all kind of assuming. And then after that, it does get a little bit wide open. You've got strong pitching in this draft, especially at the top. You've got guys that have performed very well in college with the kids that you know about, with the Martins and the Kerstads and the Gonzalez's, and so those guys have gone out and done what they were expected to do, and like I said, the pitching at the college level has done well. And then you got the high school kids. Some of them didn't get to get going, but they were really highly valued going into the year, and in some areas, some of the high school kids did get up and running. So I think it's got a chance to have some flux within regards to the top, you know, five picks. But again, as you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes around. There's a lot of rumors that take place, and I think we're in a good position. We're going to get a really, really good player at four. There's no doubt in my mind. We've argued over so many good players on this board, and I feel really confident that we're going to get a really good pick at four.
Does the fact that you're going to draft somebody and then they're not going to play, does that change how you look at them?
No, unfortunately. I mean, I think the one thing we always want to do is get the guys out on the field. And again, when you've done this and you're into this, the disappointing thing is for the players that they don't get an opportunity to go do what they love to do, and they need to play. Like, every player needs to be out on the field and playing. So, hopefully, we'll get good news and maybe something will open up and these guys can get back at it. That's the hope. It's not going to change who we take because of what's going on, because everybody's in the same boat, right? And so, do I think college players may go off earlier? Yeah, maybe, but there's a lot of good high school players too. And I think at the end of the day, the most important thing you can do is acquire talent and talent that has makeup, and you don't want to pass on that at any time based on just because one kid's not gotten to play and one kid has. So at the end of it, I think because we're all in the same boat, I think you'll see the players go off the board the way the teams like them.
Is there any? Have you heard anything about when the players might, the minor league guys might be back on the field?
No, I have not. I wish I had an answer. We get asked that obviously a lot now. As you're starting to talk to these parents and these kids, that's the first question they ask when you ask them, "Hey, you got any questions for us?" It's, "Yeah, what are we going to do if I get drafted? Where do I go? When do I sign? And where do I play?" Right? And we don't have the answer for them. You know, we told them that as soon as we can. Get guys out on the field and do things. We're going to be more than willing to do that. But right now, we're all under the same guidelines. And as soon as they open it up and let us go, we'll go.
Is any team in baseball been hurt more than the Royals right now because of where you guys are? To me, to shut down the development. No team like you guys have come down to the bottom and you're on your way up. And what you need are your young players to get innings and at bats, and they're not getting it. It hurts no team more than you in my mind. Am I looking at that right, or am I missing something?
Well, I think you're looking at it right because we care about the Royals, right? And we're all on the same page with regards to that. So we're probably a little biased. And of course, I mean, I've had several conversations with our minor league players and even guys in the big leagues that you just know how bad they want to get out and play. And you knew that they were starting to get better, and you knew that they needed the development in the big leagues and even in the minor league. So we were really, really excited, with where we were at and how guys were progressing. And we knew this was a big year, for so many players in our system. And the work that we know that our player development guys have done, and the preparation that they were, and what I was hearing was going on in spring training already with the major league club and how things were going. It was going to be a fun year. It was going to be a really good year for all of us as a staff, as an organization, and just watching our players develop and grow. And you're right. It hurts to know that they're not getting that opportunity right now. But I also know, what our player development guys have done and what they've been doing on a weekly basis with these kids, and they haven't shut down. And so I do feel they're more prepared than maybe others that are out there. I feel that the way that, what was just done last week with Mr. Sherman and Dayton, what went on, I mean, that's culture. That creates, you know, intensity and keeps guys going and stays motivated. And that's why Twitter world ran over with all of our players commenting upon it. So the vibe is as good as it can be here, and they're still pushing each other. It's just in a different way. And gosh, I wish they could get out on the field and start playing and doing what they love to do, because you're right, we needed the development. But again, we're all in the same position. It's not how we're getting through it right now. It's how we're going to come out of it. And the teams and the organizations that come out of it the best are the ones that are going to thrive and survive once it opens back up. And I feel we'll be in a good spot.
Royals assistant general manager Lonnie Goldberg has been our guest here in the program as they get ready for the draft on the 10th and 11th. Just five rounds, so only 160 players drafted. There were 1,217 drafted in 2019. Lonnie, before I let you go, I got to give you my final four quickies. Just tell me the first thing that comes to mind. And I'll start with this. Have you watched any KBO games?
I did. The very first player I ever signed is playing over there, so I did watch. I've watched a few of those. They're running real early in the mornings, though, so
yep.
Those are tough.
I'm more likely to catch the 12:30 a.m. first pitch than I am the 4:45 first pitch,
yeah.
Or 3:45
maybe through the whole game, but I've watched a few.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. When will we get a world draft?
Wow, I don't know the answer to that, and I'm good with it not being that way, if that's any.
Okay, I'll take that. I'll take that. When will we be able to watch teams trade all their draft picks?
Ooh, another tough question. When will we be able to watch the teams trade their draft picks?
Yeah, because I know right now, like, the what is it, the compensation picks can be traded, I think.
Well, I think they put in the rule next year that they can't do that. So at least for the next year, you can't even trade compensation picks. Even this year, you couldn't trade them once the thing got shut down. So
okay.
That's going to be at least another year. But yeah, that was disappointing in the regards to it, because you know, anytime you can try to add value in picks, you want to be able to have the freedom to do so. But
I mean, that we'll seems to me it would help. Yeah, like if you're upset about the tanking in baseball, then let the teams get resources faster. You do that by allowing them to acquire draft picks. And it seems
I
know why they had the rule, but it's archaic.
Yeah, I was really surprised that they didn't do that, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure what went on with that.
All right, finally, are you binge watching anything to replace sports? You got any shows you've been checking out?
To be honest, I've been so locked down watching video and on Synergy and doing Zoom calls. I don't really pay too much attention to anything on TV right now. Unless it runs across that the MLB is the season's getting ready to start, I've tried to stay away from the TV, to be honest. I'll look forward to watching baseball hopefully here soon. Hopefully we'll get this thing going again.
I'll take it. Hey, no is an answer as well. No, I haven't. That's a real answer, Lonnie. Hey, thanks so much for the time. I know it's been a lot of work, and you still got work to do, but looking forward to the draft being on TV. And it's not the full draft, but I love that we're going to go ahead and have the draft at the time, because I think fans want to see some of the normalcy, and we're going to get to do it. I know it's been tougher on you and your staff and everybody that works in it, but I think it's great for baseball fans that the draft's coming up. So best of luck with it, Lonnie, and look forward to talking to you down the road.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate being on.
Lonnie Goldberg, Royals assistant general manager, with us here in the program as they get ready for the draft. As I mentioned, the 10th and the 11th, the Royals have 32 and 41. That is their first, their compensatory, and their second-round pick. They have six picks overall, just five rounds. 160 players will be drafted. Last year, 1,217. The ones that don't get drafted can only be signed for a maximum of $20,000. I think that will be a good thing for the Kansas City Royals. I think all those things we touched on. I wanted to just get Lonnie's, you know, thoughts without cheerleading next to him while he was giving them. But I think it's going to be huge. I think the Royals, number one, have built the organizational reputation as an organization that cares about its players. I think, you know, we heard this story that Dayton Moore, back when they were building towards the 14 and 15 pennant and world championship, that, you know, one thing they could do is care more than any other organization. And they built the framework of the organization around that. That's how they wanted to build their club. I think that was known around baseball. And then chance to hammer it home with the decision they made to no furloughs, no layoffs, pay cuts only at the upper end, and even those people are going to get their money back, and then not releasing a bunch of the minor leaguers. Gets a lot easier, I would think, if you're sitting in mom and dad's home and saying, hey, I know it's 20 grand from us and it's 20 grand from the Yankees, but, you know, the Yankees cut guys. I mean, you're just a commodity in their minor leagues. Every one of our minor leaguers matters. You want to know how I can prove it? We didn't cut a one of them. They're all still getting paid. That, to me, is going to be a great, great sales pitch. And sales pitch sometimes gets a negative term, right? If you're in sales, yeah, you got to make your sales pitch. It's reality. That's a great sales pitch, and it's real, right? That isn't something that somebody's having to dummy up. That is real. I think the Royals are going to have a great situation there. Lonnie Goldberg joining us here in the program. We will take a break. Talk a little more baseball. I want to get into some Lance Armstrong as well. You're listening to the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
The program with Soren Petro.
I used to do subversive radio myself in the 70s, okay? But for this gig, we need a little more positivity, all right?
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
All right, the good sense, end of the hour answer. Hall of Famer Wes Unseld passed away overnight, age 74. How many times in his 13-year NBA career did he average at least 10 points a game?
Well, I saw he won an MVP. I saw a breakdown, an analytics breakdown, that the year he won the MVP, which he was a rookie, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was probably, based upon analytics, like, you know, war and that kind of thing, he was probably the third or fourth best player that year. He won it with a year he was like 14, 18, and like two blocks. And like Kareem was like 25 and 14.
Yeah.
Kareem didn't get
right,
it.
Right.
Because
he made his players better. Oh, sorry.
So I'm going to guess it's like, you know, he did win an MVP.
Mm-hmm.
But he was all about the rebounding. So 13 years?
13
seasons.
I'm going
to say 7. I'm going to say 7.
6.
Ooh.
Now, he was double figures each of his first 5 years, but only double figures one out of his last 8 years, and that year was 10.9. Yeah, Jed popped in this morning while I was doing some stuff. He says, Wesson still only averaged 10.8 points a game. I'm like, I thought it might be 14 or 15. I don't think it was 10. 14 boards a game, though, so he was consistently dominant at that. And for a guy who played center, almost 4 assists per game is pretty damn good.
Yeah. Listen, he was a tremendous player, but I do think that there are things to be said for, you know, okay, great player, but now we look at some things. And I think he did the things he was told to do, go hit the glass.
Yeah.
Right? Nowadays, he'd be like, hey, why don't you work on a mid-range game? You know, why don't you see if you can hit a jumper? You know, I think that you know, it's kind of like, you know, Joe Carter was told, get the bat off your shoulder and drive a guy in. So everyone's like, well, his on-base percentage isn't that great, you know? Well, I mean, that he was told, drive the guy in, right? That was kind of part of the mantra. Mm-hmm. And I remember when Frank Thomas was criticized, when people would say, well, if you'd ever take the bat off his shoulder, we might, you know, really drive in some runs. Like, okay. think about how preposterous that sounds today.
Yeah. And by the way, Unseld, he said that was 68-69 season when he won that award. He Rookie of the Year. I don't know. I might have given it to Elvin Hayes at, you know, 28-17, but
yeah.
Yeah. He only led the league in scoring and then threw down 17 boards to go with that, but went to Wes Unseld.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, to me, you know, that's stupid. Am I wrong?
Yeah. His win share is top 65. I was looking to try to see, like, other players who were kind of around him and, you know, guys whose careers are done to see, well, who was he better than? a lot of just old-time guys, Paul Arizin, George Mikan, you know. Elgin Baylor, he had a higher win share than Elgin Baylor. That's something of note. Elgin Baylor, who was a phenomenal scorer, but whatever they used to combine, you know, to determine win share, a guy who was 27 and 14 with 4 assists actually had a lower win share than Wes Unseld. So I'm not hip enough on the stats deep you know, the deep dive to know exactly why that is, but someone's getting paid to put those numbers together, and they think Wes Unseld's better than, in that regard, at least, than Elgin Baylor, a guy who scored well over two times what he did.
Yeah, I mean, that, there's defense and everything else that comes with it, but, yeah. I don't know. Great player, though, yep. Right? Definitely if you're, you know, top 65, top 100, you're a great player. It is the program, by the way. We were giving away Good Sense there. You can get your Good Sense to go right now if you'd like. Just put it in. You can even pick your time. Figure out what everybody wants. You know, if you're a Good Sense member, right, you sign in, it keeps your favorites. You can log in your favorites. Right, so like when I'm making a Good Sense run for my family, I can just go click the sandwiches that are already there with all the different, you know, tweaks that we want, no mayo, extra mustard, extra pickles, this and that. It's all saved right in there. It makes it click, 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 super easy. And, of course, the Good Sense app works that way as well. GoodSenseSubs.com. Go there today. Pick your location. Pick what time you want it. And pick your great meal, and you are ready to go. Don't forget about those Good Sense to-go meals as well. They're very, very popular and have done just been fantastic. A lot of people, including even my mother-in-law, saying, hey, you know, the meals to-go at Good Sense are great. Yes, I know. Grilled Alaskan salmon, pot roast lasagna, chicken and veggies, meatloaf, and, of course, their classic pastas as well. Come with everything you need, little sides in there as well. So you got the whole meal. Just warm it up, and you're having dinner. Right there. It's at GoodSenseSubs.com. And, of course, it's your neighborhood Good Sense. Lonnie Goldberg with us in our last segment. I will say this. The one thing that's kind of disappointing is if you look at some of the draft things, they do seem to have, like, okay, there's three guys. And then after those three guys, there's a drop-off. You know, when yeah. You look at everybody's mock draft, the
Torkelson, Martin, and Lacy.
Yeah, first baseman from Arizona State, infielder, outfielder from Vanderbilt, and then a left-hand pitcher from A&M, and then the Royals land on either one or two guys. Nick Gonzalez was a consensus guy that was going higher, and so everybody had him go into the Royals at number four, but now the guy who's been moving up the charts, and he sounds like a Royals player. I'm going to read you one of the breakdowns on him. Zach Veen, outfielder from Spruce Creek, Florida High School. So a high school outfielder, you know, they like those toolsy outfielders. Mm-hmm. Veen has a complete set of tools. He has the potential to stick in center field, but might be better suited for a corner position. The 6'4", 190-pound left-handed hitter has a chance to be an impact bat in pro ball, but he does have some swing and miss concerns in his game. He is the top-ranked prep position player in the 2020 MLB draft. Have they ever been afraid of a swing and miss?
No, and particularly in a 6'4 outfielder.
No.
Like, well, I guess Bubba was 6'5 or whatever. There's a little bit of that there.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of that there.
Sure. Yeah. That's. I mean, he does kind of fit that bill. For a team that won its world championship on contact, they oddly have an affinity for guys who swing and miss at the lower levels.
Yeah. I want to see. You know, he looks like they're guys, but that doesn't mean that he's, you know, doesn't mean that they're going to go that direction. They might still take the college second baseman, but he certainly looks the part of what Kansas City Royals picks have been. So, yeah. And here's one that calls him 6'5", 200.
And people who would say, well, second baseman, aren't they kind of loading up on second? In this, there's no such thing as, to me. You don't know what you got at second base. Don't know. If the guy can play at a premium position, you know, if you think he's the best guy, you go after him. To me, as position players are considered.
Yeah, most things now either have him taken Veen or Nick Gonzalez, who is listed as a second baseman for New Mexico State, but I've read a number of things that say he could end up in the outfield. Yeah. It's where the 20 MLB draft could start getting interesting. The Royals have a variety of options. Whether that's New Mexico State second baseman Nick Gonzalez, Florida prep outfielder Zach Veen, UCLA outfielder Garrett Mitchell, or even a college pitcher. Right now, Gonzalez appears to be the most likely option, but that could still change over the next few weeks. Gonzalez has thrived offensively throughout his college career. He hit five home runs in a game this season and finished the spring hitting 448 with 12 homers and 36 RBIs and 58 at-bats. Played 4,000 feet above sea level at New Mexico State, but his success last summer in the Cape Cod League has quieted some of the critics. He played shortstop this spring, but profiles as an offensive-minded second baseman in pro ball. And like I said, I've seen some things that have him maybe going to the outfield. And I think Gonzalez would be the guy that if you take him, you're giving him the full slot money. But I think that one of the reasons why Veen might be moving up is because there's a feeling you can get him for a little bit less than slot money, and then the Royals could turn around at pick number 32 and maybe be going after a guy that was the 16th, 17th best player that's telling people, hey, I need more than slot money to sign. And maybe instead of, you know, you're able to give him an extra $600,000-$800,000, and that gets him to sign with you as opposed to teams that are, you know, not wanting to pay that much money. So that's one of the games that I think can be played. And that's why I asked him, you know, do you think, you know, does the five rounds mean there's going to be more maneuvering or less? And he said he thought less, but as we said, there at number four, that's where things could start to get interesting with teams moving around.
And I'm also intrigued to a degree by Emerson Hancock, the right-handed pitcher out of Georgia, who a year ago would have been, I think, ranked much higher than this. There was a lot of debate whether he and Lacy was the better college pitcher. Lacy's kind of just separated himself. But any time a guy has that kind of run up to that point, you wanted to just have just one off season. Is there something, some concern? So I'm intrigued by him as a college pitcher as well.
The other one is I hear that Baltimore is the other team that could be, because they've got the 30th pick, that they could take a slot guy, take a guy to save some money and then look to get a second guy of high value. So maybe they, if all of a sudden Zach Veen goes second, then I think you've got Baltimore that's doing slot money, and then the Royals get one of those three guys, one of those consensus three guys. So, you know, we'll see how it ultimately ends up playing out on draft day. Let's take a break. I want to come back. I want to talk about a little bit about Lance Armstrong. If you've been watching that, we didn't have time for it. A lot going on yesterday. But I want to get into that next, what the takeaway is from Lance Armstrong's career, because I think there's more to it than a lot of people give it credit for. We'll do that next here in the program.
The Program with Soren Petro.
If you disappear forever, it wouldn't make any difference.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
You're in the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Lance, the two-part, four-hour documentary on ESPN. Did not carry the weight, and for obvious reasons, of The Last Dance. We have heard Lance Armstrong, saw him with the Oprah interview where he finally came clean about using performance-enhancing drugs. But I still thought good television. I don't know, did you have anything you'd do differently if you were making it, Jed?
No, probably not. I at first wasn't interested in it, and you told me that you thought I would like it a lot better after having not watched the first one live. So after watching all, what would you say it was, 3.5-4 hours, I don't think I would do anything different. I think you got a very illuminating picture into who Lance Armstrong was, and I know it's something we talked about a lot, how the comparison to Michael Jordan is right there. It's so easy to see the connection, but it was always something where I took that, I guess, going in that you had mentioned that, but I also, at least to me, saw in Lance Armstrong, and maybe it was just because of my experiences with my family and everything, I actually thought when it came to his purpose for the cause of cancer research and stuff like that kind of separated him. It seemed like he actually showed a more personal side there, where I didn't really ever see that from Jordan.
So you bought it that was... Yeah, I mean, I know he went through a tremendous battle and everything, but, you know, because he pretty much admits that he was a selfish guy.
Yeah.
You bought that, you know, because by all accounts, he did work tirelessly on that.
Yeah.
And that it wasn't about just, you know, creating his, you know, a bigger, more, you know, more dynamic brand for himself to capitalize on.
Right. I actually do buy it. And there were parts in Lance where you saw that, I can't remember the journalist's name who was following him around, he said, no, I want to go in and talk with these people individually. And I don't think if he was trying to live it up for the camera that he would have done that. I think he would have wanted to illuminate even more what he was trying to do. And as you said, to not monetize off the huge event that he was. And I think he was even blown away when he saw the outpouring of support that he received from this, because everybody's been affected by the terrible disease that cancer is in some sort of capacity. But for him to actually recognize it, I think even the most awful people can recognize that, well, I can't mess this up. This is even bigger than me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there was an element of that. And I think he's an interesting guy in the sense that he's kind of just a brat. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
And that, you know, they talk early on that, you know, his mom was 16 when she had him. And, you know, he said we were basically growing up together, that he kind of just always got his way. And that's how he, that mindset also, though, lent itself to how devoted he was to being the best. And I thought it was interesting, you know, like okay, yeah, the guy took drugs, but just like Barry Bonds, you know, Bonds was a great player. He became a freak show when he started on the steroids. Lance Armstrong was going to be one of the best, right? He was going to be world class. And you know, I think if you said every Major League Baseball player is going to play and we're going to absolutely know that they're not on steroids, you might have at the end of that come to the conclusion that Barry Bonds was the best player of all time, right? If everybody was on a level playing field, it was possible. And I think the same thing with Lance Armstrong. Do I think he wins seven in a row without steroids on the Tour de France? No. I mean, they talked about how just it was lucky, just you don't crash, you don't, you know, you don't get sick, you don't have, you know, there's just no bad days when you do that. I don't think you could have that kind of longevity and be that injury-free and not get worn down without the steroids. I mean, I think they were key to him winning seven. But could he have won if nobody was on steroids, which it seems like that entire sport was, but could he have won four of seven, five of seven? Yeah, I think he could have. I think he could have. And so I still think he's one of the greatest cyclists of all time. You know, his name will forever be tarnished, and there'll be people that hate him, and he tells some of those stories that are there. But there's no doubt that he was a ruthless competitor and winner.
Right. And to me, the where you bring in Barry Bonds and the similarities there and how his name's tarnished, it's, again, a different sport but kind of the same idea. I've never seen Barry Bonds' name as tarnished. Granted, I'm biased because he's probably my favorite baseball player of all time, steroids or not. But everybody in the game of baseball was either turning a blind eye or taking advantage of no testing. Everybody in cycling was doing the same thing. So if you're breaking records and proving that you're able to do that when essentially the best of the best are doing the same thing, I don't know how you can diminish that and consider that tarnished. I get it in the essence that we want our competitors to be 100% honest and pure athletes and play for the love of the game. I think, unfortunately, that's naive, but I do think that if you're going out and still kicking everyone's ass when they're doing the same things that you are, that's saying how good you are.
Yes. I mean, I watched the Tour. I still watch the Tour de France. I think it's a great event. And it's fun. I love the scenery and the backdrop and everything that goes with it. But, you know, that was Can't Miss TV. And he said something in there that I thought was interesting because I think he's right. You know, that he was on the Jordan Tiger, he was up on that level. And if you don't think he was, you're wrong. He was like the AP athlete of the year, male athlete of the year, like four times. He won ESPYs. I mean, he was a giant star. And they told the story in there that he was out with Matthew McConaughey, and more people wanted to talk to Lance Armstrong than wanted to talk with Matthew McConaughey.
Unbelievable. And a cyclist, and not even in a mainstream sport. When you just keep talking about comparisons, it's funny because you keep thinking about more people that pop into your head. Like you said, Tiger and Jordan. He was Tiger in the fact that it wasn't one of the big three sports. He was Bonds in the sense that he was so driven to be the best that he would do anything. He was Jordan in that he had the ruthlessness to be the best of all time. So that's what made it to me compelling. And like I said, I never thought cycling would have me that intrigued, but the backstory and the different guys and teammates coming out, the pettiness that he had, he talked about these different world-class cyclists, calling them out, calling them bees and stuff like that. It was unbelievable. I loved the documentary when, again, I thought I wouldn't.
Yet there was one guy, Jan Ullrich, who won the Tour de France, I think, what, a year or two before he won his first one, that he had tremendous respect and admiration for, who'd gone through some mental illnesses, that he said, Jan got me up early. He made me what I was because I respected him. I feared him. I knew I had to be up. I knew I had to be training, or I couldn't beat him. And so, although he's such a, like, he still seems to be all about Lance, doesn't he?
You think? Even in his home situation where he was now, when he's making dinner with his, I think, still fiance, but his current life partner, or whatever you want to say.
When they're, who he has how many kids with? Two or three?
Two or three.
Just so but, people understand.
Yeah,
they've
been together 10-plus years, so I think that they're on pretty terra firma with where their life's at. But he's sitting there, and he cuts his hand, and yeah, it's just little things like that. And granted, yeah, he's in front of the camera, but little moments where you're expecting to see a guy who's sharing moments with his kids and his wife, he still made it all about himself, and to me, made him look like a jackass. But there was no guard that was ever let down. Like the line that Curtis kept referencing, he couldn't find a way to separate himself on the bike and off.
Yeah. That was, and he said that. I thought what was very telling, his first marriage, he had three kids, a son and twin daughters, and his son plays football at Rice now, or did during the time that they were recording this. And he went there and he spoke to the team, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'll be rooting for you. Like, none of you more than 48 there. And they got the camera on his son, and his son just kind of got this blank look on his face. And so they get done, and he's chatting with his son and somebody else while he's on camera. And he's like, yeah, you know, I'm 35. He's like, what?
What? When that happened?
Yeah, you know, I'm 35. He didn't even know his own kid's number. I mean, come on. Is that acceptable?
No.
It's like, yeah, whatever. Like, you didn't know my number, Dad. Like, come on, man.
And when he's walking out, 35, got it for next week, 35.
Yeah.
The kid's just kind of nodding along. All right, Pop.
Yeah.
I'll see you
right,
when
get
I
the
see
hell out of here. Get the hell out of here. I mean, the kid didn't bash him, but he certainly didn't have glowing terms about what it was like to be him. That and the money was big. He talked a lot about the money. Oh, I sold that house for, you know, I bought it for like, you know, $600,000, built, you know, whatever. It sold it for over $2 million. So, you know, like the money came up a lot. Did you notice that?
I did, and the finances and different lawsuits and things that he had going on. He did mention money a lot.
Like he very much wanted to tell you how much he'd settled for to let you know that, yeah, I wrote a check for $5 million. I mean, I think he's still doing well. He seemed to have a beautiful house there in, what, Aspen?
Mm-hmm.
Is where he lives right now. But what cannot be denied is he raised millions and millions of dollars for cancer. I mean, there has never been anything like the Livestrong bracelets. Like, that was an absolute phenomenon, and people still have the bracelets now that mimic the Livestrong bracelets. But it was staggering. Of course, and then that tugged at so many people have been touched by cancer. That's what was the driving force, which is what you spoke to, Jed, there. But just amazing. What he did on that front. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll get you what you need to know. And Nate Taylor from The Athletic joins us next hour here in the program.
The burnt end of the hour question, brought to you by Joe's Kansas City Barbecue in Olathe, Leawood, and the original in the gas station at 47th and Mission.
All right, born on this date, pitcher Jim Maloney, he threw two no-hitters for the Reds. How many pitchers have thrown more than two no-hitters in their career? Brought to you by Joe's Kansas City Barbecue.